This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse or call us at 860-275-7266. We're joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Bilal Sakhu, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford. Bilal, good to see you once again.
Thanks a lot.
And Christine Stewart is here. She's Editor-in-Chief at ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Good morning.
And we're going to start right here.
Silver pines, the sun half an hour high. Been waking up early and I don't know.
That's Hartford Mayor Luke Bronin from his self-titled 2012 EP. Yes, he's a songwriter, in case you didn't know. Maybe he'll be going back to that. Luke Bronin this week said, "I'm not going to be running for governor anymore," after he jumped into the race. Let's listen to a bit.
I said at the beginning that I was going to get out and explore and listen, and that's what I've done. As I've done that, I've also kept my obligations and responsibilities to the city of Hartford at the forefront of my mind. And, you know, I believe that this is a critical moment for our state, but it's also a critical moment for our city. And we've achieved tremendous progress in partnership with the state over the last few months. I want to make sure that that progress doesn't get politicized.
So, Colin, I'll ask you first. Did he get out of the race because, A, he wants to make sure that Hartford gets everything on track and he thought that he could do a better job by staying mayor? B, he wants to actually follow up that EP with a full-length record, maybe with, I don't know, Ryan Adams or somebody like that? Or C, some other reason?
I'd like to think it was B.
I really would. It's a catchy tune, by the way. There's a lot of good songs on there.
One of his songs got used on Dawson's Creek. That's actually true. No, obviously, he got out of the race for the reason that everybody who ever gets out of a race gets out of a race, except for the people who have scandalous photos or whatever. and that is because he had no clear path to victory. And I think that was becoming more evident to him. Probably the decisive thing, we'll never know, but probably the decisive thing was internal polling that was prohibitively low, but also just out there in the outside world. Although he showed some facility at raising money, and Christine could probably talk about this in a more granular way. The money wasn't necessarily coming from the places it would need to come from to really connote support, the kind of support that he would need. I would guess his delegate count was maybe a little bit off even heading into the convention. I mean, I just don't think he had, he was additionally handicapped by the fact that he was unable, he was almost kind of not welcome to seek the support of unions and the Working Families Party. All of those things conspired to make it really difficult for him.
Yeah, he wasn't invited to the AFL-CIO convention. It was applauded when, you know, his presence was not going to be accepted at that convention. So he had a labor problem. He's Governor Malloy's former chief legal counsel. So
he had a Malloy problem.
Recently, as part of the state budget that was passed last October, they gave a 20-year guarantee to pay Hartford's debt. So he had a Hartford problem.
Well, or let's call it a suburbs problem.
Okay, a suburbs problem.
Because the problem with Hartford, some of the problems with Hartford still exist. He's been trying to turn some of those things around. But the big problem with the bailout is that's not going to play very well in all the places that he really needed support outside the cities.
No, that's true. You know, and so there's, you know, there weren't enough delegates to get him the support that he needed within the party. And I think that he realized that.
But what's so interesting, Bilal, is, and we've said this a lot on this program before, right now at this time in American politics, we have a whole lot of people who seem unprepared to go and be politicians. They've never run for anything before. They've never necessarily run anything. They've never understood what legislation is like. Luke Bronin is someone who seems to have been almost designed in a lab to do this kind of work. He's worked at all different levels of government. He's an incredibly smart, accomplished guy. He has a military background. There's so many things that he brings to the table here. So how is it that this kind of perfect candidate doesn't get off the ground in such a big race?
Yeah. I think in many ways, the points that have already been made really explain a big part of why he dropped out of this thing. But what's interesting to me also is this sort of you know, dilemma, I think, on his part, for him at least, that he made a promise that he would serve out a term, and he even suggested he'd serve out two terms. And I think there's something really important about getting the job done at the local level. Hartford has a lot of challenges, and I think making a move up, while that might be good for his political career, I think it breaks a promise to the citizens of the city of Hartford that he made, that he would try to turn that city around and fix the problems. And I think doing that would perhaps give him the kind of resume he needs to take on the kind of problems the state of Connecticut has. But if he's not willing to show commitment to fix those things in the city that he was elected to come in and fix problems for, then I think he's made the right move, and he should stay in Hartford, and he should try to turn Hartford around and get it on the path it needs to be on.
Well, I think, too, Colin, there's also a moving on up at the wrong time problem here. If you are a young, accomplished person who wants to maybe someday be governor of Connecticut or have even higher aspirations than that, throwing yourself into a race with 30 other people or whatever it is, at a time at which you could get the job, and then the job would be the worst thing ever as you try to fix some intractable problems at the state level. Problems, frankly, that are even worse than Hartford has, because at least in Hartford, you can ask the state for a bailout. I mean, I don't know. The timing seems wrong in so many ways. You said this right off the bat when he originally announced.
Yeah, and I mean, everything that Bilal says is really, really true. I mean, this is going to follow him around had he stayed in the campaign. I think also, you know, political intelligence is really different from other kinds of intelligence. So, I mean, like, Luke Bronin's a really, really smart guy, and I've had a chance to get to know him a bit and just also watch him in action. He's an incredibly smart, you know, he and his wife are like, you know, if you're going to have one of those interstellar situations where you have to send some people in a rocket ship to a different planet and start the human race over. I mean, other than the fact that the human race would get a lot shorter, they're like really incredibly talented people in every possible way, and they're attractive, and they're, you know, and they've accomplished. I mean, she's an architect and a lawyer, you know, and he's been in naval intelligence. I mean, their resumes, you know, they're in their mid-30s, late-30s. Their resumes are like somebody who's 65 years old. But that's not political intelligence. Like, somebody that smart running against a reasonably crafty and shrewd mountain lion, you know, the mountain lion might win that election, because political intelligence is much more about guile and craft and kind of getting your nose up into the wind, you know, and kind of understanding stuff like that. So I looked at this thing from the very beginning. I think all of us did, and thought, what is he thinking? You know, there's, starting with everything that Bilal said, he's got a huge problem. He said he was going to stay, and he's not. And when you break your promises, you know, on the first day of your campaign, that's a hard thing to shake off.
I think the fact that there was no clear front runner either on the Democratic or the Republican side in this race, and there still is not a clear front runner, made it very attractive. And I think that, you know, there were some people who really thought, you know, hey, I can enter this race and get it done. And Luke was one of those people.
I mean, absolutely. But I think this is just one of those moments where ambition gets out ahead of a track record, a proven track record of success. And to me, the work that he needs to do is the work of turning the city of Hartford around, highlighting those things that are going really well in the city, and trying to deal with some of the structural problems and some of the fundamental problems and challenges the city has. Get that job accomplished, and then you make that move up. Otherwise, this becomes about you and your ambition and not about the promises you made to a city that needs help with its schools, that needs help with, you know, policing, that needs help with its fiscal situation. Fix that before you make that jump up.
Just a couple of quick observations. Luke's primary political experience was running against somebody who was in trouble. In other words, Pedro Segarra it was a relatively easy thing to craft a campaign arguing that you could do a better job than Pedro Segarra, who's a very nice person and not an inept person, but his mayoralty was not in good shape. It's much harder in this field where, as Christine says, it's crowded, there's no clear front runner. One thing that I will say is we may, after all this is over, want to slightly tweak the citizens' election program. So, like, back in the old days, you know, if you said to, like, a lot of these candidates, Prasad Srinivasan or you know, Luke Bronin or, you know, Susan Bisowitz, or, yeah, you can run for governor, you got to go raise $6 million. they would have said, well, I can't do that. But if you only have to raise $250,000 to get into the game, not that that's easy. It's hard. It's hard to raise that
especially
money in small amounts.
Especially if you're raising it in small amounts.
And the truth is, you don't want that person who could raise $6 million. There's all kinds of reasons. The reason we have a citizens election program is we don't want that person who could go out there and raise $6 million from all kinds of interests to whom that person would then become beholden. But we now have a program which generates a lot of candidates at a lot of different levels. It's expensive and it's a little bit confusing, and it's gotten as confusing as it ever could get, I think, this year. Although I would also point out at the gubernatorial level, by my count, there are six people who are running without the citizens election program.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let's say, you know, if you raise the $250,000, you still have to qualify for the ballot. So you still either have to get 15% at the convention or you have to go out and collect the petition. So not everybody's going to get the $1.2 million. And it's really interesting that the Republican candidates for governor have been able to reach that $250,000 threshold, and none of the Democratic candidates have been able to get there.
I also want to point out, just for the sake of amusement, that, I mean, one of the questions we might ask ourselves is, where is Bronin's support, such as it is, his convention support and otherwise, where is it going to go? Last night in the south end of Hartford, there was a meet and greet, complimentary food and drink, courtesy of Joe Ganim, for Hartford delegates to the convention. So this man, does talk about a guy who doesn't like pass up many opportunities. You know, this guy, he's in it. He's in it for real. This isn't some kind of stagey kind of thing. He's looking to pick up delegates.
He's raising some real money. And he loaned his campaign $35,000, you know, himself. So, you know, he actually could be viable. If none of these candidates qualify before the convention for that grant, they're not going to, based on the SEC meeting schedule, they're not going to be able to access that money until July, a few weeks before the primary.
And what you have here, I'll stop breaking in, what you have here, and it's kind of an interesting situation, with primaries happening in August, you could have two parties with no opportunity to introduce their candidate, their actual candidate, to the public until early September, which is a pretty short window.
Yeah. I think with most of these candidates, that could be a real problem because most of these candidates are really unknown to most people. And I think in many ways, that was also part of Bronin's problem. And I think it will be a problem for most of these candidates who are running. I know at the very beginning, I worried about what the impact of this would be on the CEP, having this large number of candidates. But what I'm seeing with people dropping out as well is, you know, my sense is that a lot of people will quickly come to the realization that they really don't have a viable candidacy and we'll pull out. So I'm less worried about the impact on the program money-wise that I had at the very beginning.
Bilal, I know you're very involved with some of these organizations that favor this. Do you see maybe an argument for a tweak, like a bumping up of the ceiling, or is 250 still, you think that's about where we should be? Or?
At this point, I like the 250. And what to me is most important about this program is that it creates a retail kind of politics here in the state. It forces these candidates to get out there, to meet people, to raise those small donations, to not rely on lobbyists, to not rely on deep-pocketed individuals, which I think would greatly impact this race in a much different way, given the fact that there is no incumbent who is occupying that office. And I think the way money would come into our state for this governor's race and how critical it is nationally we're talking about local politics, but I think the national impact of this race will be quite significant if you see a situation where Republicans win the governorship and potentially take control of the Senate and the state. I mean, that signals something to the country that may be a reverse direction from what we may see in other states around the country.
Well, given that the conventions are coming up very quickly in May, given the fact that not everyone's raised the $250,000, Christine, who do we see as possibly now exiting this race? From what Bilal just said, well, we're probably going to start to see some motion now. Who's next to drop?
So what's interesting is that there's no Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor at the moment. So I think on the Democratic side, you could potentially see some of those candidates, maybe someone like Jonathan Harris, drop down to a lieutenant governor position. And so I think that probably Susan Bicewicz is going to qualify. Ned Lamont is not participating in the citizens election program. So automatically, he's a more viable candidate if you're a delegate to this convention, because he's going to have the money and resources to get his name out there before the primary.
Colin, a quick thought?
There are people angling for lieutenant governor. Michelle Cook is often talked about, but she's also often talked about as somebody who could jump into the fifth.
Yeah.
There are sort of people kind of looking for it. I would say that right now, Jonathan Harris probably picks up some of the bats and balls that Luke Bronin just dropped. Mm-hmm. In terms of resources and maybe even people that he could hire and stuff like that.
Bilal, any thoughts?
Not really. I mean, I think the two of them have pretty much summed it up.
I mean,
it's just hard to figure. I mean, there's still, what, about 20, 25 candidates on the Republican side or something? How do you figure that out?
27 candidates total.
I mean, how do you figure that out? I mean, it's like a roll of the dice. I mean,
you got Peter A. Thalheim?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll go down the list in just a little bit. We're talking with Bilal Sakhu from the University of Hartford, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, our own Colin McEnroe. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some things happening at the Capitol and also who else might be running for governor. It's coming up next in The Wheelhouse.
Oh my Lord, no it won't be long, no it won't be long, till you reach your arms down to me, down to me.
This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news. As always here, and you can join us at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse, and you can call us at 860-275-7266. We're joined today by Christine Stewart, who's editor-in-chief at CTNewsJunkie.com, Bilal Sakhu, who is associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford, and Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
Well, we're turning our attention to something that puzzles a lot of people, which is, how can evangelicals support Donald Trump, knowing what they increasingly know about Donald Trump, with each passing day disgorging a new Playboy bunny or whatever? So we're going to look at – I mean, not all evangelicals support Donald Trump anyway. It's a big mistake that's made to talk about them as though they're one group. But that'll be a lot of our questions today. And Sarah McCammon, one of the great NPR reporters who grew up in an evangelical church, will be with us.
NPR's great Sarah McCammon will be joining us. Great. That's today on the Colin McEnroe Show at 1 o'clock. Let's move on to a news story that you broke last week, Christine, about a sort of an odd, racially insensitive remark made by a state senator, Hartford's John Fonfara, to a black female lobbyist. It's getting a lot of reaction at the Capitol, and it's very unusual. Why don't you explain, first of all, what exactly happened with John Fonfara?
So Arvia Walker is a lobbyist for Planned Parenthood, and she goes up to the Capitol on a fairly regular basis and to lobby lawmakers, and she wears a Stand With Black Women pin. And so she was lobbying Senator Fonfara, and he noticed her pin, and he said, "I need a Stand With White Men pin." And she tried to explain that there was a lot in in his response to that, and that's not, you know,
what you
that
say.
Wasn't something that you say. And I think that, you know, Senator Fonfara has apologized, but there hasn't been sort of the same reaction as there hasn't been the outrage that there's been in other incidents, I think. And so there's something missing here. And it's either Senator Fonfara or, you know, in how he relates to people and how people think that he was maybe trying to relate to her and just maybe did it in this racially insensitive way that wasn't appropriate. So nobody's calling for his resignation.
Nobody's calling for his resignation. There are some people with some outrage at the Capitol. I don't know, Bilal, this is one of those stories where you hear it and you think, okay, is this a guy saying a dumb thing that he knows he shouldn't have said? Or is this emblematic of a much larger problem that sort of allows a large group of people, white men basically, to think that they can say all sorts of things and get away with it? I don't know. How seriously should we be taking this?
Well, you didn't offer the C, which was all of the above.
All of the above,
right.
Yeah. So yeah. So all of the above.
I think we'll see. I think all of the above. This is an interesting moment we are living in, and this is where, for me, the local and the national politics come and blend together. We have a president in the White House who speaks that way all the time, in, you know, coded ways and sometimes in quite explicit ways, that it occurs at the state level where something that just should not come out of your mouth comes out of your mouth, I think is just a reflection of the kind of atmosphere that we're in. I think, you know, there's a kind of awareness I think we need to have in American politics about the role of white identity in politics. That going back to the election, I remember I, you know, made the argument that race played a very significant part in this election, and that when we talked about the white working class and issues around the reemergence of the kind of old-fashioned racism you hadn't seen since the 60s started to reemerge, and there's social science research to support this, you know, argument. And I think for a lot of people, there was a desire to deflect from that, to really say we've moved beyond that, that, you know, this is not the 1950s or 1960s. And I think this has really brought to the surface a kind of comfort for a lot of people to sort of say things, and this sense that they've got things on their chest that they need to get off their chest, this sense that whites are now victims, that whites are now in a position where they're the ones who are disadvantaged in society. And I think, you know, that kind of slips out from time to time when people start talking.
I think Senator Fanfara is saying that, you know, and basically he went on to say, you know, you should walk a day in my shoes to a black woman.
Stop talking now, Senator. Stop saying words.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I think Senator Winfield in his Facebook Live post kind of explained it that, you know, you don't have these experiences that we have. So don't try to pretend that you do, because in pretending that you do, you have your own set of experiences. But don't try to make our experiences invisible. Don't make us invisible.
But in many ways, that's that sense of victimhood that I think this presidency and this election cycle really brought out, which is not to suggest that white working class people have not suffered under deindustrialization and the problems that have occurred in our economy, the wealth inequality, the squeezing of the middle class and the working class. But this presidency has sort of brought to the surface this notion of white victimhood that now has become a kind of narrative that people are running with. And unfortunately for the senator, that was the narrative he ran with.
Colin?
Well, I mean, it was just such an incredibly stupid thing to say, and I just can't get past the stupidity of it. It's weird because a lot of the people who say these kinds of things are the kinds of people who are kind of isolated and insulated from, you know, from any kind of racially diverse work environment or experience. But that would not be the case with a senator from Hartford or anybody up at the legislature. I mean, there are, you know, there's a fair number of African-American and Latino legislators, and there's an awful lot of people, as this incident demonstrates, coming up there to talk about a lot of these issues. I mean, you know, he on a daily basis should be hearing a lot of these concerns. So I can't even wrap my mind around what was going on in his head. But what I would say about this is, if, in fact, this is really, really troubling to anybody, which it should be, there's a very easy remedy, and it doesn't really involve calling for his resignation. It's called a primary. You know, he's an elected official. They're up every 2 years. You want to get rid of him? There's a really easy way to do it. And I would say, you know, I don't know that much about Senator Fanfara, although I have covered his remarks about some other things that did not illustrate to me a keen grasp of nuance and issues. I would imagine it would be relatively easy to craft a highly spirited primary campaign against him.
Well, okay. So since we're back into the politics of this a little bit, we just have a couple minutes before the break. Bilal, one of the things that we wanted to note here is as we look at this ticket, all these people running for the statewide races for governor, but the other statewide races as well, we see an awful lot of white faces. As Colin said, in the legislature, there is a bit more diversity. At the Capitol, there is. But to be fair, people who work at the state Capitol tend to work with an awful lot of people who look like them. And we've got the same thing happening on the governor's race right now, too.
And I think that's a very good point. And I think when Senator Hoder Winfield spoke about this, he talked a bit about this more sort of deep problem that occurs at the legislature in terms of the kind of policy that gets promoted, that comes out, and some of the frustration he's experienced with some bills he thought should have received a more fair sort of treatment. But I think the problem that you raise is, I think, a very important problem. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine just yesterday about this. I mean, when you look at the staff around the key sort of, you know, staff around the legislative leaders, again, mostly white, certainly leadership mostly white. It is a white space. And for a lot of those legislators, they live in communities. And I think this is the case for most whites in America, is that they live in communities in which they don't have very deep relationships with people of color at all, as friends or neighbors. And so it isn't surprising to me when you hear statements like this, because I think it really reflects some deeper sort of problems we have in our society.
We have just a minute left, Christine. I mean, any thoughts or anybody talking about the lack of diversity, say, at the top of the ticket on both the Republican and the Democratic side?
No, and I think that that's a problem. I don't hear that there is a lot of talk about it. You know, I think that we had some talk about gender and allowing some of the female candidates to participate in some of the debates, but we haven't heard anything about race.
I mean, it's our congressional delegation as well. I mean, so this, right, you know, yeah, this problem runs very deep in our state.
It's not just the top of the ticket, it's the whole ticket, right? Sean Wooden is probably the only African-American running for treasurer right now, who has a chance of being on a statewide ticket that I can think of. There are a number of South Asian people on both sides and some Asian people. But, I mean, this is for the incredible number of candidates that we were talking about before, it's amazing how many of them are white.
We're going to come back in just a couple minutes with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, with Bilal Sakhu from the University of Hartford, and with Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. But right now, we're going to go to some friends of mine who are in the other room. They're going to ask you for support for WNPR Connecticut Public Radio, because you pay for all of this. You pay for the great news, the analysis, all the talk shows. Everything that we do here on Connecticut Public Radio is because of you, our listeners. So here are some friends to tell you how you can support WNPR right now. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news today with Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio, Christine Stewart, who's editor-in-chief at ctnewsjunkie.com, and Bilal Sakhu, who's associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. There have been a few new developments in what's become the evolving saga of whether or not we're going to get another casino here in Connecticut. On Tuesday of this week, Attorney General George Jepson in a Wall Street Journal report sort of doused the already iffy project to maybe put a casino in East Windsor. This is coming at the same time, Colin, that it seems as though MGM, which has been putting up a casino in Springfield, might have its eyes set on another casino project closer to Boston. I don't know where exactly we want to start with this, but from what George Jepson says, this whole idea of the tribes going in and building this third casino might not happen anytime soon.
Right. And I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I'm certainly not the attorney general. But it seemed as though the opinion issued by Jepson made a lot of sense, that if you're not building on tribal land, you should probably get Department of the Interior approval for this. I guess I'm going to move away from a second. There's two things that I'm taking away from this. One of them is, I mean, the first thing that we have to remember is we're not talking about a goose that lays golden eggs that is at the peak of her fertility. This is an aging goose that, you know, lays fewer golden eggs every year. The handle at all the casinos are going down, There are other kinds of betting options, and there are more casinos. So this, no matter where anything gets built, it's not going to be as productive as it was last year, and last year wasn't as good as the year before. So you have to sort of start there. Like, we're fighting over an industry that's kind of dying. I think also we might be burying the lead here. To me, as I'm reading about all this stuff, I'm thinking, well, depending on what the Supreme Court does, we're going to have sports betting in a lot of these places, which I don't think would be a dying industry, at least not at its outset. Legalized sports betting, I would imagine, if this New Jersey case is decided in such a way as to open the doors, I think there'll be a rush in a lot of state legislatures, including ours, to get sports betting out there. And that, in fact, might be a much more productive thing. So I don't know. I tend not to get all worked up about the casino thing one way or another, because I don't see it as having kind of a long game.
Might be a more productive thing, I suppose, sports betting, Bilal. But at the end of the day, we're still making public policy based on the notion that we should raise money to go into our general fund by allowing people to bet more. We've legalized Keno. We're maybe going to put up another casino to compete with Massachusetts. It feels to many observers as though this is a race to the bottom.
You stole my comment, actually. I mean, this to me is one of the most bizarre things that we have based public, you know, this notion that we can generate money from gambling. and that we can give people more ways to gamble to generate more money. And to me, that is really bizarre. And it just shows how we won't deal with, I think, some real issues that we have in the state about raising revenue that we need to address in terms of our corporate tax rate and our rate on people who are very wealthy in our state, which are better vehicles, to me, to raise revenue than trying to figure out how to perhaps get people who are addicted to gamble even more.
So what happens now, Christina, if indeed there is still appetite at the state capitol to figure out a way to stave off a threat from Massachusetts and put some sort of other casino in Connecticut, if you've got the attorney general saying you really do need authority from the federal government, then there's the specter of, is there another casino bid down in Bridgeport, which has been talked about for many, many years? I mean, what exactly is happening around casino gambling at the Capitol right now?
Right. So I think House Speaker Joe Arisonwitz kind of hit it on the head a few weeks ago when he said, I don't really think anything's going to happen. Look, we got 17 days left in the legislative session. The most that they can hope for is to pass a bill that allows them to study this issue. I don't think that they're going to, you know, they actually are also, they have legislation to get rid of the $30 million that the tribes were supposed to pay Connecticut, you know, to help us balance our budget in order to build that casino. So I think that's gone. So $30 million gone, maybe a study bill at best. There's no way that this lawsuit is going to be solved before then.
Yeah. I tell you, the other thing that's intriguing to me about this whole story is apparently if MGM buys the casino near Boston, Massachusetts law says they can't own two casinos in the state, which means
Correct.
The Springfield Casino, which isn't completed, would have to be sold, and that the Indian tribes in Connecticut are interested in the Springfield Casino. I thought initially this whole conversation about building a casino in Connecticut was to keep jobs in Connecticut, but now the tribe wants to buy the casino in Massachusetts. So what happens to the Connecticut jobs angle? And Colin, will Connecticut be able to collect taxes from Massachusetts for money that the two tribes make in Massachusetts to bring back to the state?
Right. So you have phrased it perfectly when you say the Connecticut jobs angle. This was always, I mean, the jobs argument was always a charade. They don't care about jobs. They care about money.
Exactly.
And they're not too picky about where they get it from. And so that notion, first of all, the notion of this kind of, you know, this casino slot box sitting up somewhere in along I-91 as if gamblers were salmon swimming upstream or shad or something that you could kind of intercept before they got to Springfield. It always struck me as a little bit fanciful, but it was never about protecting jobs. It was about protecting money.
Okay. Before we move on to a last topic, I just want to quickly say, Christine, you were at the Capitol yesterday. What's happening with a minimum wage bill?
So the minimum wage bill did get through the Appropriations Committee yesterday. So it's on its way to the House.
And who's supporting this? Who's behind a minimum wage bill? And what does it look like at the moment?
Well, I mean, it's party line at the moment. I mean, Democrats are supporting it. Republicans are opposing it. And the reason Republicans are opposing it, because if you increase the minimum wage, you also, based on state and municipal contracts, those contracts also have to increase. So the cost to the state of Connecticut for increasing the minimum wage is $50 million. Add that to another $320 million deficit, and we're just continuing to dig here.
It wasn't an increase in the minimum wage part of this nonpartisan plan that was come up with it was led by Jim Smith. and Bob Petrocelli that had so much hoo-ha at the Capitol for a couple of weeks. That was part of their plan, right?
That was part of their plan to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour, but you had to buy into the entire
right.
plan.
You had to buy in the entire plan.
Yeah, if you weren't going to buy into the entire plan, you can't just increase the minimum wage.
And that entire plan right now is
nowhere.
Gathering dust.
It's gathering dust. I don't know. It's a conversation that's being had around the country right now in various state houses, in cities as well. Bilal, the idea of the state saying we need to raise the minimum wage to something that some people call closer to a living wage. There's always going to be pushback from business groups.
Yeah, it'll be pushback. But there was a major tax cut that was recently given to corporate America and wealthy individuals in a society that was thought to produce this kind of scenario where workers' wages would increase, and especially people who are at the bottom of the wage scale really need that increase to happen. And so this is that moment where I think, you know, state governments and the corporate sector needs to put up or shut up. You've got your tax cuts. You've got your money. Unfortunately, a lot of that money has found its way into stock buybacks. It's found its way into a rising stock market, which has fattened a lot of 401k plans, including mine, for example. But it hasn't gotten down to those folks who need it the most. I saw somewhere that on average, probably about an extra $300 a year for many workers with this tax cut, which just doesn't cut it in terms of what was promised and what's needed out there for people all across America.
Quick thought, Colin?
I would just like agree with 100% with what he just said. I mean, you know, there's two reasons to raise the minimum wage. One is it's the right thing to do. I mean, people really can't live on what is the existing minimum wage without having multiple jobs and no time for their families and stuff like that. And the other reason is it's good economics. I mean, if you want to get money circulating into the economy, I mean, give it to people who are going to spend it because right. they have to spend it, as opposed to people who are going to consolidate wealth in other ways.
I want to move on to something else. We've had so many stories, Christine, over the course of the last couple weeks about school walkouts, massive anti-gun rallies. There was a rally this past week, pro-gun enthusiasts, the Connecticut Citizens Defense League rallied at the state capitol. You were there to cover it. I mean, what did you see?
Yeah, you know, so it was 1,500 people, which in comparison to the gun control rally, which was about 3 weeks ago, there were more than 10,000 people there. So a smaller number of people, you know, fighting for, you know, to make sure that the state doesn't ban bump stocks or, you know, ban ghost guns. So there's very little left that, you know, they're negotiating over.
So it's a much smaller group. And this happens at a time when the sad specter of the Sandy Hook shootings is once again in the news, in large part because a few parents of Sandy Hook victims are now suing I think it's fair to say, reprehensible Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist who has spread lies and rumors about what happened at Sandy Hook. They are suing him, Colin, for something like $1 million for the pain and suffering that he has caused their families.
Right. I just want to quickly say that I didn't go to this rally, but in the past when I've gone to things like this, you know, and the guys who are there, at least a lot of guys, always say, you know, it's really a mental health problem. I always say, so when there's a mental health funding rally up here in a week or so, you guys are all coming back, right? Like, because you really care about mental health funding. No, none of those guys are coming back for that. In terms of Alex Jones, once again, I have to say I'm not a lawyer. I don't entirely understand how defamation law works. I will say he may be in a special and very interesting and ironic kind of trouble. If you remember Alex Jones's highly contentious custody case, one of the things that he had to argue at the time was that the person that he was on the air was a persona. It was a persona crafted for the purpose of entertaining people or whatever gratification people get out of watching Alex Jones and InfoWars. If that's the case, he may have dropped some of the protections that often attain to journalism. You know, with journalism, you know, the rough standard is absence of malice, not reckless disregard for the truth, all this kind of stuff. I think there's no question that he's had reckless disregard for the truth in the case of claiming that people are crisis actors when they are, in fact, bereaved people living through one of the worst tragedies in American history. But it would be kind of funny, anyway, if he lost this case partly because he's already admitted he's not a seeker of the truth. He's a guy with a persona that happens to resonate pretty well with a certain kind of audience.
Bilal?
Alex Jones, wow. Just watch the show and you will get a sense of just how much of a quack he actually is. And so what he has done and what others have done on what happened in Sandy Hook, what they have said about the shooting in Florida and other shootings that have occurred, and these kinds of attacks on, you know, people who have been victimized by gun violence in our society is just reprehensible. And so my hope is that they win that lawsuit and move on to the next person.
Well, I think we saw kind of a real change with Parkland and the students speaking up for themselves and not allowing some of these personalities like Laura Ingraham to get away with some of this stuff and actually, you know, hitting them, you know, in their pocketbook with their advertisers.
Yeah.
I know we wanted to loop back to this, Colin. We just have a couple minutes left, but this issue again comes back around as we talk about the potential race for the 5th Congressional District here, where we have heard talk about Sandy Hook parents getting involved in that race to fill Elizabeth Estey's seat.
Right, so two of the Sandy Hook Promise parents have been talked about. There's no question that they're being approached by the DCCC. This is now a seat that's in play nationally. Both parties are very worried about retaining it. They're looking for candidates increasingly. I mean, you look at Connor Lamb down in Pennsylvania. You know, both parties are looking for kind of profile candidates, you know, who fits the profile of the kind of person who could win in this situation. The one thing that I have to say is a campaign is a really hard, grueling thing. And whether we're talking about Bill Pettit on the Republican side or the two Sandy Hook parents on the Democratic side, it's a hard thing to put people through. It's an easy thing to call somebody up if you're in the DCCC or the RCCC and go, you know, you ought to run in the 5th District. Well, it's a hard, hard thing to do. It's grueling. You expose yourself to all kinds of stress and exhaustion. And if Bill Pettit and say Nicole Hockley were to run against each other, there's a 100% chance that one of them would lose. And you sort of feel like these people have been through enough. I just hope everybody thinks about that. It's just such an easy thing to say, right, tell somebody else they should run. It's a very hard thing to run,
especially with some of the things that have already been said about some of these folks, which is at the heart of this lawsuit against Alex Jones. Some of these people have to face horrifying things being said to them online and in person almost every day of their lives. I want to thank Colin McEnroe, as always, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WMP. You've got a great show coming up today, Colin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Bilal Sakhu, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford. Thanks, Bilal.
Go Hawks.
And thanks to Christine Stewart, Editor-in-Chief at ctnewsjunkie.com. Thank you so much, Christine.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by Scott Brady. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Kion Wolf is our technical producer. Intern Garnet McLaughlin also assisted with our show. Now, here are some folks to tell you why and how you can support Connecticut Public Radio.